I am not Deborah Wexler. Dr. Wexler is our executive director, and unfortunately, she had a medical emergency that occurred on Friday, and it was one of those visits to my office late Friday afternoon that said, Diane, you're going to have to give my presentation because I'm not going to Dallas. So I'm using her slides, and I hope I'm capturing the essence of what she intended to say. What we're going to talk about is vaccination errors, but more importantly, how to prevent them. And I want to thank both Donna Weaver from the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, and also Teresa Anderson, who is one of our consultants, who take many of the questions on these issues and answer them, and have been very helpful in providing input into this presentation. These are the types of vaccination errors that I'm going to address, and I'll start with storage and handling of vaccine. Look, guys, we spend so much of our time trying to educate providers about how to administer vaccines, dealing with the complicated schedule that's changing every year. We publish it every year to capture the nuances and the changes, fortunately, the new vaccines and the changes in recommendations. We try to educate and motivate parents to get their children vaccinated on time and with all the vaccines that they need. And we need to make sure that we're giving them viable vaccines, because we don't want to give them the false impression that they're protected against a disease that they're not. The results of storage and handling errors, of course, can cost a lot of money. We all know how expensive vaccines are today. Extra time and money when you have to revaccinate individuals or even whole cohorts of individuals that were given vaccines that were not properly stored. You have to then explain to those irate parents why they're needing to be vaccinated again. And of course, you'll have to deal with the media that'll pick up on the stories and publish the headlines that you don't want to read. And I apologize to the five states that are listed here. This is just a sampling of some of the real headlines that have hit the media, and I'm sure there's probably similar headlines for all of you that are not represented up here as well. It's no fun to deal with that. Well, how to avoid storage and handling problems? Here are some tips that will help you to prevent those occurrences from happening. And in a little bit, I will give you some resources that capture all of these points and more. And I'm speeding through a lot of slides. Dr. Wexler gave me a lot of slides, so I'm not going to go into detail on any one slide in particular. I was hoping we would have handouts, and I know Dr. Wexler was too. Do we have handouts in the back? I don't think so, because I haven't seen them in any of the breakouts, but you know they will be posted on the CDC website in several weeks, or if you can't wait, you can email admin@immunize.org, and we'll be sure we get you one ahead of time. So I apologize, I can't go into a lot of depth, or I wouldn't leave time for the remaining speakers. Generally, you know, there's frozen vaccines, and there's those that are to be stored in refrigerated temperatures. MMR, varicella, MMRV, and zoster tolerate freezing. The LAIV and the rotavirus in the live virus vaccine category do not, and they deteriorate rapidly after you remove them from the refrigerator. The inactivated vaccines, on the other hand, are actually affected by freezing. You don't want that to happen, and you don't want to keep them out of refrigeration for any length of time either. You don't want an occurrence happening over the weekend when someone is in working on your power system and they inadvertently or overtly remove the power source to your vaccine. So you take measures by putting stickers on the near the source where that power is connected, and warning signs, and of course have temperature alarms if your temperatures fall outside of the recommended ranges. In terms of vaccine handling, you only want to open one vial of vaccine at a time. Store vaccines separately from one another so you're not going to get confused. Don't store vaccines in the door of the refrigerator. Don't store it with your food. Some vaccines are light sensitive and must be kept in their original boxes. And rotate stocks of vaccines so you're always using the one with the shortest dating. Pre-filling syringes is generally and strongly discouraged by CDC and can result in many vaccine administration errors. There are some exceptions, however, if you have, for example, influenza clinics, which frequently you'll have large numbers of people coming through and you want to get a little start on things. You can pre-fill a little bit in advance, or manufacturers obviously have a lot of pre-filled syringes. Any of those syringes, other than those that are pre-filled by the manufacturer, should be discarded at the end of the day. Or if the pre-filled ones have had their caps removed or the needle attached to the syringe, they should also be discarded. Reconstituting vaccines, another major source of vaccine errors. Live virus vaccines and some inactivated vaccines must be administered promptly after reconstitution. And if they're not administered within that time limit, they need to be repeated. Here's some of the time limits for those that do need reconstitution. And you'll see that varicella, Zostavax, and MRV both have to be administered within 30 minutes of reconstitution and also protected from light. Yellow fever has up to an hour, MMR has up to 8 hours, and the other two there listed have up to 30 minutes. Here again are some of the resources that are available from our site that will help you in following those rules for both storage and handling of vaccines. Here's more of those. And of course, CDC has storage and handling resources on a toolkit that's at this URL. And again, it's going to be hard for you to copy all this down, but hopefully you'll get the handout. And they also have a 20-page guide which provides lots of detailed information on storage and handling of biologicals. Well, the second group of vaccine administration errors are it's administration of the vaccine. And the types of administration errors that we hear about are the wrong vaccine was used, the wrong diluent was used to reconstitute it, the wrong dosage, the vaccine had expired, or the wrong route, site, or needle size was used. General recommendation is check that you have the right vaccine. Check at least 3 times. And some of these tend to look similar. There's a lot of D's over there. PPD, of course, is the tuberculin skin test. DT is the pediatric formulation of diphtheria and tetanus for children. And big T, little D, this is one of the major areas of confusion, is, of course, the tetanus diphtheria that's given to individuals 7 years of age and older. The diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccines, we have now 2 products. We have the product that's recommended and used in pediatrics, and that's the DT acellular pertussis, DTaP, some people call it, and then we have TDAP, which is, I mean, the same letters, but different order way of nomenclature there, but TDAP. Now, this is Dr. Wexler's way of thinking of it, so I have to think how she would think. She said, think of DTaP as DTaP-peds. This is for peds, 6 weeks through 6 years of age. And TDAP, think of, and I'm not sure I have this one, maybe you can correct me, tall DAP. Have you heard this before? From her. What did she say? Tall DAP, which means what? Adults are tall and children are little? That's the only way I can think of it. And I didn't want to bother her to get that clarified. But okay, if you heard it too, then it's confirmed. Okay, we get lots of emails from people that do write to admin@immunize.org. And it's usually they've made an error. Now what do they do? And this is briefly, again, here's someone that gave TDAP to a 5-year-old. or someone that gave DTaP to a 50-year-old. Now, what do they do? Well, here's the general rules that the ACIP has adopted for their recommendations, and that is if you gave DTaP to a person who's 7 years of age or older, they should have not done that, it can be counted as a valid dose. If, however, you gave TDAP to a child younger than 7 years as either dose 1, 2, or 3, don't count it and give them DTaP now. You don't have to wait any period of time. Give it to them right away. And you can correct me if I'm wrong. Okay. It's nice to have an expert here. If you give TDAP, however, to a child as the fourth or fifth dose, you can count it as a valid dose. But don't do it again. Okay. More errors. They use the wrong diluent, and this is probably one that happens quite frequently. Actib has its own diluent. You must use that particular diluent. Trihibit, on the other hand, uses the Actib vaccine plus it uses Tripedia as the diluent, and that creates the Trihibit, which is used as the fourth dose. Fourth dose, this is another error, so for children 12 to 15 months of age. It's an error if it doesn't happen that way, is what I mean. MenImmune has sterile water that's supplied as a diluent, and then MMR2, varicella, MMRV, and zoster all use sterile water. As a general rule, those diluents are not interchangeable. The one exception is the diluent for MMR and MMRV, which both use the same sterile water, basically, so they are interchangeable. If the wrong one is used, you must repeat the dose. Giving the wrong vaccine will rarely cause a problem, but it could lead to more vigorous local reactions. The patient may be left unprotected against a disease. Obviously, there could be additional cost, inconvenience, and loss of faith in the provider. Here's a call about a woman who took her twins in to get their vaccinations, found out the next day that they had gotten the wrong one. And she says, "I'm planning to find someone else to care for my twins. It's scary that not only the doctor messed up this order, but the nurses that gave the vaccinations did not even question it." So loss in trust with the provider. You don't want that. Another administration error is giving the wrong dose. One of our staff gave pediatric Hep A. What do we do? Answer is, if it's less than the full age-appropriate dose, it should not be counted, and revaccinate them with the appropriate dose. We have a piece on our website particularly for Hep A and B vaccines because they can be confusing in terms of how much of the dosage you give, what the schedule is, the intervals and whatnot. And then of course combination vaccines enter into that as well. This again is on our website and you can download it. Don't ever give split or partial doses. They are not counted as valid doses. Maybe some of you remember, and maybe I think it does still occur today, people giving split doses of or partial doses of DTAP. Used to be DTP because they knew there were reactions. And where does this come from? And, you know, the Red Book said specifically you do not do that. They normally do not count if someone doesn't get the full dose, but there are some exceptions, and that is if someone sneezes after they got the intranasal influenza vaccine, or if a child were to spit out or vomit part of the rotavirus vaccine. Still does count. Don't combine vaccines in the same syringe unless the FDA has approved it for that purpose. Expiration date, if it says 8/15/06, that is the last day it may be used. Don't use it on the 16th. If it says August of 06, it can be used through the last day of August. Don't use it on September 1. A physician just called and said they gave an expired dose. What do we do? Repeat the dose. If it's a live virus vaccine, then you have to wait 4 weeks. That's a bit of a pain. But if it's an inactivated vaccine, you can give it at the same day or any other day. Administration errors using the incorrect route, site, or needle size. These vaccines are all given intramuscularly. Use the thigh for multiple injections. You use the in infants and young children, the deltoid in children older than 1 year, and of course in all adults. Separate the injections by at least 1 inch. Administer vaccine and immune globulin separate sites and consider combination vaccines. Or you can follow, this is on the in the pink book, this is a piece that Michigan developed, and it can tell you how to give, I think it's 8 different vaccines at one time. Ooh, but remember there are combination vaccines. One of our nurses accidentally gave Zoster IM instead of sub-Q. Always follow the recommended route. If this does happen, ACIP recommends that the vaccines be counted as valid, don't do it again, with two exceptions, and that's hepatitis B and rabies vaccine, which you must repeat. Some other things to think about, syncope does occur, most often in adolescents and young adults. Consider observing patients for 15 to 20 minutes. OSHA regulations don't require that you wear gloves when you administer vaccines. We get that question a lot. And you don't need to change needles after the vaccine dose has been drawn up into the syringe. And ACIP also does not recommend aspiration when administering vaccines. There are no data to show that this is justified, that you should aspirate. Again, here are some of the resources that are available. We also have on our site, and we acknowledge the fine work from California, an administration techniques DVD that addresses all of these issues that are up on the slide. Third is scheduling. Here are some of the common errors: giving that fourth dose of DTaP too soon, or the first dose of MMR before 12 months, giving pneumococcal polysaccharide every 5 years, where did that come from, or finishing the Hep B series before the infant is 24 weeks of age. Using Trihibit for the first 3 doses in the series, remember it's only licensed for the fourth dose, giving rotavirus after the infant turns 8 months, giving Hep B, giving any vaccine before 6 weeks other than Hep B, which of course you give at birth, and restarting a vaccine because there's been a long interval. Most commonly we get that question for hepatitis B, and we had it every year, I think. I was at the health department too. If you don't follow the recommended intervals for minimum for the age, then you don't repeat it, or you do repeat it in some cases if they don't follow minimum, but it's always the maximum, except for oral typhoid vaccine. You want to keep up on this information, I think is what the point of this is, that people call and they say, I know this, why didn't my provider know this? Because I did my research, you know, Google equals research, but hopefully they will get some good sites. And they want to know why somebody doesn't know that. There is the 4-day grace period. It is not used to schedule vaccines. It is used to look retroactively if the dose needs to be repeated or else. All of the records are in registries now, and your registry may kick it off if it doesn't meet the minimum interval that's set up for the registry. Gardasil, do you need to start that over again? No, but there are some minimum intervals, again, you have to respect. How quickly can we catch up? You know, in the recommended childhood and adolescent schedule that CDC issues, there is a catch-up schedule, and that frequently is more often the tool that's used on trying to figure this out. Again, here are some of the scheduling resources. I'm going faster and faster. And you can get schedules on both CDC's website. We have laminated versions that are down at our booth where we have done that the last several years. I'm a consultant on the schedule work group, so I get some advance notice on what they're going to look like, so we try to get them published as soon as possible. Society of Teachers of Family Medicine also has a nice version that can be downloaded to your palm. And lastly, documentation. we hear all the time, I never got a VIS. I personally experience that quite frequently. People don't understand why they don't have to sign something. That's not required by federal law. It may be required by your state law or by the clinic's policy, or that the clinic or the person administering the vaccine is not recording all the needed information. So this is a story about someone who his child did have an event occur after their vaccination, didn't know what to do, found out that they should have been given a VIS, and now they want to report this adverse event, and they want to know how to do that, and they're questioning if they should take their child back to that physician. Do the parents need to sign? No, there's no federal law requiring that. However, there is some required information. We have an example of a vaccine administration record. We have a blank copy, and then we have several examples on how to fill out the record that's maintained in the patient chart. One thing that we say over and over again is that for the combination vaccines, record the information in each row for each of the antigens that are given. So we want to avoid these vaccine errors. You're looking for help. Keep current as best you can. CDC publishes the Pink Book, which you can download off the CDC website, or you can purchase a hard copy for your office. It's very comprehensive in covering all the issues you need to know. A lot of our materials are actually published in that as well. The most relevant ACIP recommendations, both provisional and final, are posted on our website as well as, of course, on CDC's website. We have Ask the Expert questions and answers, which we post on our website, which are often the situations that you saw now. I did something wrong, now what do I do? You know, you're not going to see that in the ACIP recommendations, but you'll see it in Ask the Experts. All of our questions and answers are thoroughly reviewed for technical accuracy by CDC. And we also publish a weekly email update on everything new and in the field of immunization. It's in very short segments that it's easy to read. It goes out every Monday afternoon. If you're not a subscriber, go to our website and subscribe. And if you need more help, email CDC's expert. You probably take some of these questions, I'm sure. You'll get right to an expert. Contact your vaccine rep or call the manufacturer, your state immunization program manager, or you can email us again at admin@immunize.org. And that concludes my presentation.
Thanks, Diane, for a wonderful presentation. It's very comprehensive. Thank you for that. At this time, we'll take questions. We ask that you come up to the mic so that we can hear you clearly, as well as this is being recorded. We have tons of seats up front, at least 20 to 30 seats. So I see some people on the floor. We'll give you a chance to move up front, and we'll have the first question.
I'll just yell.
There you go.
Oh. Got it.
I'm Peggy Howe from Oklahoma, and I can just kiss your feet because I love your site.
Thank you.
I learned so much from it.
Thank you.
It's the best site. And I just want to put a plug in for that one training video that you said from California.
Yes.
I actually use that video to train every single nurse that comes in to our clinics, and I do make them watch a lot of different videos, but that's the one they say they learn the most from. So it's an excellent teaching. And
thank
your
you.
Site is just wonderful.
Thank you so much. And thank you to California for giving us that.
Hi, Diane. I just have a question. Last year when we were at National Immunization Conference, they were really pushing us for that after vaccine administration error had been done and someone had called us for information, that we really encourage them to report that error to the Institute of Safe Medication Practices. Is that still the case?
Do you know?
It's right now to the ears.
Oh. Go ahead.
Okay. We're recommending now that all adverse events be reported to VAERS, and then VAERS in turn will then report it to the ISMP, but that's our last.
But her question is about vaccine administration errors?
Anything that potentially could have caused an adverse event is still
reported. Oh, that too.
Yeah.
To VAERS, I guess. Yeah.
Okay. Hi, Monica at Texas Children's Hospital. I was wondering if anyone has ever looked at the storage and handling for mobile vans. In Texas, we have a few mobile vans, and some of the criteria really doesn't apply to the mobile vans who have to go from a refrigerator in their clinics onto the mobile vans and then to ice coolers or chests or what have you if they're doing services off of the mobile van.
I'm not aware. I can think of when varicella, for example, was first licensed, and it was very, very temperature sensitive and had to be at those very cold, freezing temperatures. And there was some accommodation made for taking that vaccine off-site, you know, to the church basement, and how that needed to be transported. So it's kind of analogous to your mobile van, which is a little bit different too, but I guess to answer your question, I'm not aware of anything particular to mobile vans, but there may be some analogous situations you could use.
I noticed that hepatitis B, didn't it used to say that it was, if it was given in the gluteal muscle, that it was invalid, and then they changed it to just anything anything other than IM? I don't know if that's true, but my concern, and it's more of a comment than a question, is that I see so many infants that I feel like in doctor's offices where medical assistants are providing vaccine, or any vaccine provider that feels like perhaps they're being less invasive by going more shallow than deep into the muscle tissue on IM injections, that it causes swelling, redness, a lot more irritation to that fat tissue. And, you know, I'm concerned about if Hep B is, if it must be delivered in the muscle, then I think we need to make sure that we are teaching providers how important it is to go deep into the muscle with that hepatitis B vaccine, because those fat baby legs, I mean, parents look at you and they see that 1-inch needle and think, oh my gosh, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I try to always explain that that's really important to deliver it deep into the muscle so that it won't have that reaction that they're concerned about. But I wondered if you got any questions about that or if you have any comments about any of that.
Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah. Okay. Sure. Really, going back to your initial statement, no vaccine should be put in the gluteal muscle at all because of the excess subcutaneous fat in that area, of course. But the recommendation is still to use the 1-inch needle and to reinforce that to all providers to administer the vaccine into the muscle using the 1-inch needle. So it has been studied and is safe to use that in infants.
I will say that the next iteration of the general RICS, however, there has been some changes, modifications in some of that information. For example, 7/8 needles, as I understand, don't really exist, and we used to always have them noted. But there's probably going to be more emphasis on the 5/8 inch needle if the technique is such that they're stretching the skin and doing the deep insertion. So actually in our pieces, we have incorporated all of that, and CDC has reviewed it. So there is some latitude offered there for using a shorter needle, you know, depending on the body mass that you're injecting into.
Take our last question.
Hi, I'm Carolyn Cook from Tacoma, Washington, and I do a mobile immunization clinic, so I wanted to respond to the person who asked the question. And we put thermometers in all of our packs to make sure that we measure, that we're continually monitoring the temperature inside of our coolers. And for varicella, you do have to use dry ice or a VaxiPak, and we put thermometers in there also. And Cheryl McIntyre is here from Canada, and they have done some wonderful studies that show you how to pack and where to put ice in the coolers that will maintain temperatures, and they have different recommendations for summer and winter. So if you talk to her afterwards, she has some really good information for you.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. And I do T for tall and D for diminutive.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Thank you, Diane.